Our first speaker this afternoon is, as you see, Colonel Edward B. Towns, who has succeeded to the management of his family's concern, the Towns Hospital in New York City. He and I were talking at lunch, thinking that there ought to be perhaps a plaque placed in the hospital because this is where it all began. However, I suppose we'll never be able to do this because we are, after all, anonymous. But we in AA shall be eternally indebted to Towns Hospital and its staff and its ownership for what began there 25 years ago. And now I know you're eager to hear Colonel Towns.
Mr. Chairman, Sister Ignatius, doctors, and ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whether I am privileged as a non-alcoholic speaker to say hi, Ed, but I'm going to say it just the same.
Hi, Ed.
It's all right, boy. I want to preface my remarks here by stating that I speak only for Towns Hospital, which is a private, proprietary hospital, and the opinions I voice are strictly our own, although they have been tested over a period of almost 60 years. The founding of the hospital, I think in its way, is just as remarkable, if not fantastic, as the spiritual experience of your co-founder in the founding of AA. Because my father was a Georgia boy whose schooling was very seriously curtailed through the efforts of a northern general known as Sherman. In fact, not only did he not get higher education, he was lucky to get halfway through the first phase. So when this man was faced with this inspiration, challenge, whatever you wish to call it, at the turn of the century and embarked without medical knowledge, but with a sense to work with medical people on the treatment of addictions, it was truly a remarkable phenomenon. I think he was the first articulate voice who said that addicts of all classifications are sick people. That was a long time ago. In fact, it's only practically since the last war that, as someone put it, they've taken the alcoholic patients out of the back room of the jail and treated them as sick individuals. I can't go into many of the fascinating historical stages of this, but I've only been active in the hospital for 16 years, but I can assure you old-timers that I can remember when the ladies came in hansom cabs with their ostrich plumes. In fact, my mother admired the hat of Lillian Russell so much, she gave it to her. The present hospital was opened at its location in 1914. And with one exception, I think, of my father's only really mistaken judgment, it has been devoted exclusively to the treatment of alcoholism and addictions ever since. And that exception was that he was firmly convinced, although he was very much in favor of it, that prohibition would put him out of business. So he installed the facilities of a general hospital, which I can assure you now have not been used in 25 years, and during prohibition he never had it so good. And the next historical note, in 1932, by one of those lucky happenstances, he met Dr. Silkworth on the street and asked him where he was going. He said, "I don't know," he said, "I've just been in this hospital that failed across town. I'm looking for an office," whereupon he was escorted into Towns Hospital and he stayed there till he died. And of course, it was a very wonderful relationship. And the last item of historical interest, which your chairman has already referred to, is the matter of Bill's spiritual experience and his being a patient in the hospital in the fall of 1934. Now let's get to the hospital. We feel, especially with our AA patients, which I will touch on later, that we are sort of at the grassroots of the treatment of alcoholism. Many of these patients, in fact, a great percentage of them, are being hospitalized for the first time. It is their first contact. They've asked for help. Their families have asked for help. They are in such condition that hospitalization is necessary, and they are brought to us. We feel a very, very great responsibility, therefore, in the reception and treatment of these people, and so that their first experience will be as favorable as we can make it. And therefore, we start with the first premise that we must treat these people not as drunks and to a lesser degree dopes, but as sick people. And the attitude of our staff, medical, nursing, administrative, housekeeping, must be to regard our patients and give them the understanding, because after all, you have been through the mill, many of you know that a patient just coming in is not a fellow walking into a hospital for an appendectomy. He can come in really in rather rare condition. In fact, we had one fellow who was so convinced his horse was an alcoholic, he brought him in too. And almost got him on the elevator. The funny aftermath of that was there was a lady whose husband had called us on previous occasions, said, "Never admit my wife unless I okay it, otherwise you won't get paid." Well, that's quite a stricture that you want to pay. So she was waiting in the front office, and then trying to back this animal around to get him out. He wanted in the front office, and she came too out of this fog with his horse's face about 3 inches away, and she went into hysterics. And we quieted her down, got her upstairs, and it was a hurry call for me, and I had to go up. Because the boys on the floor had heard nothing about the horse episode and said, "Look, sister, I've seen purple zebras, pink elephants. Don't worry about horses. That's nothing." It is another finding that was crystallized by Dr. Silkworth in a publication in 1937, and on which we proceed, that alcoholism, in his words, was the manifestation of an allergic reaction. Now, I don't, in the presence of my learned colleagues here, attempt to make that statement dogmatic. I do say this, that on two counts, it works extremely well. Those two counts are this. Many an alcoholic has a latent fear that he is a mental case. If you can give him the assurance that his inability to drink liquor as the normal drinker is able to do it, and that is, whether it's chemical, metabolic, or dietary or otherwise, is a phenomenon that exists in him, you allay a fear. And allaying a fear is a very important thing in proceeding with treatment. It also gives us the right to say to him, once this is established, we have never seen a properly diagnosed case reverse itself. And we hold out no hope to you that you can ever drink normally again. Now, there we're playing fair with him. He may not like the bad news, mind you, but at least there it is. And we base it on that theory. We know there are plenty of fine authorities who are inclined to question it. But after all, we are concerned chiefly with taking the acutely sick alcoholic and restoring him to normal physical functioning as quickly and as benignly as we can do it. We must send him back to his work, to his profession, to whatever his calling is, in good shape. And if we are going to do that, we must confine ourselves primarily to the physical end of the treatment. Years ago, it was a greater problem than it is now, because we have an adjunct at this time which can take care of the sobriety therapy, which is going to follow his hospitalization. But our job is a physical one in the first instance. As one side comment, which I think AA has taught us in our medical work and which has been extremely satisfactory to us, when I first joined up some 16 years ago, all alcoholic patients were tapered off. That was the way it was done. That's the way it had always been done. Then Silkworth, who was our medical director, as well as the director of the AA ward in Knickerbocker, said, "We're beginning to do it on a dry basis." Well, we shuddered at the thought, but we took one floor and made it dry. Now we have only one floor where the taper offers still insist on their quota, before they give up the ghost. And you know, there's one interesting reason for that, and I've seen this happen in my time. One reason for that is that years ago, a voice would call me on the phone and say, "Hi, I'm fine, how are you?" "I'm great. Look, I've got to have a bed next Friday." By the time next Friday came, and he came, he had had it. 10 years later, the same fella comes up, jumps out of a taxi, bounds up the stoop, and I don't know what he's coming in for, maybe to see about a bill or see a patient or something. "What are you doing here?" "I had 2 drinks before lunch." And here he is for admission. And then the fun starts, because his drinking cycle is just the same as it was 10 years ago, but he wants to finish it with us, you see. And I said, "Well, why work this on me?" He said, "Here, the furthest I can fall is from the bed to the floor. And I feel safe. I know I'm not going to get clipped. I know I'm not going to get rolled. I'm not going to disgrace the family. So, that's it." Then the fun starts, as I say. Now, I want to change from that subject to our relationship with AA. Of course, we're more than proud of our historical beginning. And that in itself was a remarkable thing, because if you are a hard-boiled administrator, owner of a hospital, I'm referring to my father now, and a very smart and very unemotional and very much matter-of-fact doctor as Silkworth was, and had a fellow say to you, "I have just seen God," the first thing they dash for is a paraldehyde. Because That is really a DT symptom which you don't often meet. One fellow congratulated me on a Muzak setup I had, which was connected with heaven, and God talked with him every day, and asked me how much it cost to put in, which naturally didn't exist, and no Muzak in the hospital. But these two men saw it immediately. They were not religious men in the churchly sense. At least I can speak for my own father. I know he wasn't. Yet they saw this thing early. In fact, long before Bill ever went to Akron and met Dr. Bob, he was starting in a very, very elemental way his 12-step work in the hospital. As he said afterwards, "I was wrong the way I did it, because I was telling them. All the rest of the evolution came afterwards when they worked it out." But we saw it. In fact, my father was one of the first ones who said to him, "You've got to put this in a book. Word of mouth is not going to last too much longer." And proceeded to assist him in the not only the writing, but the publication of the book itself. So that is a very, very pleasant memory to look back on. Now, how do we work with AA in the hospital? Well, I might say to start, we work very pleasantly. The intergroup organization in New York is a professional, highly competent, very human, very understanding organization. The present ladies who are in charge there, Doris and Adeline, and some of the male volunteers, know exactly what their problems are, and they know what our problems are. But AA has one great advantage in my hospital, which I don't say as an advertisement. That is, we're doing the same thing, that's treating the same type of patients long before they came there. We're pinpointed to this work. Our staff is organized for this work. They're not mad because they had to take time away from a lung cancer case to let some drunk come in the front door, you see? And they don't sabotage things for that reason. We know that whether an AA sponsor or a family bring a patient in, they want to get him upstairs and get him to bed fast, and so do we. Because if he sits around too long, he knows that just exactly one block away are a flock of bars, and he must have one more before he's admitted. So the faster we can get him up and get him to bed, the faster he's going to be helped. We work strictly on a sponsor basis, except between the hours of 8 p.m. and 10 a.m. when An AA can bring a patient in, provided, of course, he has not been in the hospital before. He only has one, in the AA floor before. And then we check in within a group in the morning, and then he's cleared as an AA patient. The stay is for 5 days. He has no telephone calls, he has no visitors, he can't see his own doctor, he can't see his own clergyman, he can't see anybody but AA. I might say parenthetically that this causes us more trouble than any other thing, because I've yet to see an alcoholic who lands in a hospital in bad condition and hasn't left business and everything else pretty well fouled up. And he's wondering what's happened to his wife. He's wondering what's happened to his business. He wonders if he's got a job. He's got the telephone. That is done through his sponsor. He may not be done as quickly as he wants, but it is done, and we would very frankly, when we took all the telephones off the second floor, leaving only one in the nurse's station, we wish we could have done it on the upper floors as well. Because if there's one thing that an alcoholic gets, is telephonitis, and he gets it bad. On this floor is another excellent AA rule. The ladies and the gentlemen are segregated, except for the two closed meetings, which are held on Wednesday evening and Sunday afternoon. Those are led by regularly selected meeting leaders, and at those meetings, of course, all the patients who are able to join in. It's an excellent thing because it gives them their first indoctrination and orientation. And when they leave with their sponsor and go to a meeting, it isn't as if this was a strange program that they're going into. No television is permitted on the floor. Now, they think that's because I am so chinchy that I won't put one there. But that is an AA rule. And I must say it's a very good one. The boys can play cards, they can listen to the radio. But it's a very difficult thing for a sponsor to come to visit a patient when the Yanks are playing the Cleveland Indians at Yankee Stadium broadcast on television. I know if I were AA, I'd have to be awfully, awfully strong-minded to resist looking at least at an inning or two. Now, one other item on the AA floor, because, of course, in running a hospital like this, if I had 3 hours, I could probably keep you laughing over the funny things that happen. We have a great advantage on that floor that these patients have, except for a fractional percentage, have never been in the hospital before. Whatever the nurse hands them out in the way of medicine, they take. Not upstairs, but on that floor they do. Upstairs, the old-timers, they won't take this and they won't take that, and their invariable phrase is, "Now look, Colonel, you know my case. I can't do this and I can't do that." One of the most important medicines they don't take because it interferes with their looking at television. But a maverick, I'll have to... What was the last one?
What was it? I think you're referring to a laxative.
No. Oh, I beg your pardon. It's belladonna. It's nothing else than that. I'm sorry, I was so slow on the uptake. Now you see what type of minds make. About 12 years ago, the Squibb people came to us. I'm going to tell this as a little story because it's so funny. And they asked us to try out a preparation of mefenazine, which they marketed under the name of Talserol, as a central muscular depressant and relaxant. And so we did. Well, it was first delivered to us in the most vile-tasting stuff I ever tasted in my life. So they sent little bottles of cherry flavoring along, which we put in this. And the doctors didn't know how much to give, so we figured an ounce would be all right. We gave an ounce to several fellas, and it was just as if they'd turned a spaghetti and they went flat on the floor, so we cut it down. But we couldn't keep this cherry flavoring in suspension. So Squibb said, "We'll make an elixir out of it." Well, happy days for Towns Hospital. The elixir had 20% alcohol. And you would be surprised how many fellas needed relaxing just before lunch and dinner. So, when AA came in, I said, look, we're not going to... There are two things I don't want to fool. One is Coca-Cola, and the other is Tylenol. Because these fellas want to drink coffee and Coca-Cola and say, look, I can't sleep. I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't sleep. Five bottles of Coke and four cups of coffee. And Tylenol, they agreed with me on, and everything went fine until I say this maverick landed in there who had been on the upper floor, and he said, the nurse, where's my pink lady? And she said, we don't serve them on this floor. The first thing you know, I have to go up to Duffy's Tavern, and here's an indignation meeting. We're paying our money here. Why can't we get this pink lady? These are the boys who've never heard of it before. And it took a little bit of persuading, but I was glad to get that lad off the floor because he knew too many answers. Now, I've made some observations here, and I want to repeat my opening statement that what I say is applied to my private hospital, and I would say other private hospitals that were holding out their facilities for the treatment of alcoholic patients. I don't think that facilities whose main work is mental should treat alcoholic patients, or I don't think alcoholic patients would be treated in those facilities, even if physically they are separated from the mental patients, because the attitude of the staff handling a predominance of mental cases must be to regard anyone there as a variety or as a variant of mental cases. Now, you can't do that with alcoholics because they aren't mental cases. And I've talked with many a lad who has been hospitalized in various parts of the United States where the facilities are generally mild mental cases, alcoholic and drug addiction. And they've told me that the locking of the doors and the clanging of the bars and the orderlies walking around, you know, ready to restrain them in case they kick up a little bit, and they kick up all right. We call our kick-ups clam bakes, and our clam bakes generally start in the evening. The day is peaceful, but the clam bake starts in the evening. Another thing is that, and this I want to impress on you, and I don't want to be, treat it lightly, and that is a subject which is a very, very serious one for any of you concerned with alcoholics and their welfare. We have noticed the most dramatic and very sadly dramatic change in the condition of patients coming to us for treatment in the last 7 or 8 years. In the early days, as one fellow put it, a drunk was a drunk and a dope was a dope and three cheers. But it isn't that way now. We are using medications. True, they're not terribly new medications, but we're using medications in quantity than in Silkworth's day we never even had in the hospital. We must be prepared in receiving patients today to cope with prior medication before they came in, ranging anywhere from chloral hydrate to morphine. And in between, we have the barbiturates, we have pyraldehyde, and we have tranquilizers. I think I should probably write a testimonial thanks to every pharmaceutical firm that's putting out tranquilizers, because he certainly is doing my business an awful lot of good. Now, we have to recognize one important thing, or two things. One is logistical. Thank you. One is logistical, and the other is factual. There are certain people who are prone to an addiction. They may go through life without being exposed to narcotic drugs or pills or alcohol, and they may die happy, the fact they never addicted to anything. But if you ever expose them to it, and if they take these drugs, and I'm speaking of the non-narcotic drugs now, to relieve them from either the aftermath and the tensions of dissipation, or the tensions created probably by unwise habits such as excessive smoking and coffee drinking, they are very apt to become addicted to the new drug. And the use of these drugs in excess are much more deteriorative, much more dangerous, and harmful than certainly their alcohol was. In fact, I told one fellow, he wasn't on the AA floor, so I haven't broken any faith with you. I said, if you have to get drunk twice a year, get drunk twice a year. For heaven's sake, but leave pills alone. Because he's beginning to get that awful fear that it generates in the user that if he doesn't have it, he's going to have convulsions, or he's going to go into delirium tremens, or he's going to have something terrible is going to happen to him. And I can say truthfully that we're not fanatical on any subject except warning our patients against the dangers of these drugs. And as you know, there's a great brotherhood of alcoholics. There's an interchange of information today that didn't exist 15 years ago or 10 years ago. And one fellow says to another one, I tried the best darn pill my doctor gave me. When I had a hangover, I snapped out of it like that. That's for him. And we see, of course, the really sad results. Now I've had my warning red light here. I like to close, of course, and this is not meant to be perfunctory, in thanking you for according me the privilege of appearing before you. I will say that we have learned more about our own work in dealing with the alcoholics referred by Alcoholics Anonymous, because we have them in a better control situation than our own patients who take the liberties they think they are entitled to. And I can assure you that we regard it as a great duty, a great obligation, and an obligation well performed where we can help and start them on what we consider is the only sensible program that will ever assure them of continuing sobriety. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colonel. I understand now why in certain irreverent circles in New York they refer to your institution as Town's Hospital.